जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। यशोदनंदन व्रज जन रंजन। यशोदनंदन व्रज जन रंजन। यमुना तीरावन चारी। यमुना तीरावन चारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। यशोदनंदन व्रज जन रंजन। यमुना तीरावन चारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे। हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे। हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। जय राधा गोपीनाथ राधा गोपीनाथ राधे। जय गौर निताय जय गौर निताय गौर निताय जय गौर निताय। Jaya Shri Gopal, Shri Gopal, Shri Gopal, Jaya Shri Gopal. Jaya Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Jaya Prabhupada. Jaya Jaya Gurudev, 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 Jaya Jaya Gurudev. Jaya Vishnu Pad Paramahansa Parivajakacharya Stotarata Shri Srimad, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai, Premse Kaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Ganga Mai Ki Jai, Yamuna Mai Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Devi Ki Jai, all glories to assembled devotees, all glories to assembled devotees, all glories to assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskrityam Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tathojaya Mudiraye Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. So we're reading from Canto 1, Chapter 6, chapter entitled Conversation Between Narad and Vyasadeva, text number 17. So please repeat after me.
Prematibhara nirbhinna Pulakango timeshita Ananda samplave lino Napashyam ubhayam mune Prematibhara nirbhinna Pulakango tinevita Ananda samplave lino Napashyam ubhayam mune Premati bhara nirbhinna Pulakango tinevita Ananda samplave lino Napashyam ubhayam mune Pulakango tinivrita Ananda samplave lino Napashyam ubhayam mune
Samplave nino Apashyam ubhayam mune Mataji
प्रेमाते भर निर्भिन्ना सुलकान गोति मेवितः आनंद संप्लवे लीनो नापश्याम उभयम उमने प्रेमा लव अतिभर एक्सेसिव निर्भिन्न स्पेशली डिस्टिंग्विश्ड पुलक फीलिंग्स ऑफ हैप्पीनेस अंग डिफरेंट बॉडीली पार्ट्स अति निर्वृत बीइंग फुली ओवरवेल्म्ड आनंद एक्सटेसी संप्लवे इन द ओशन ऑफ लीन एब्सॉर्ब्ड इन न नॉट अपश्यम कुड सी उभयम बोथ मुने O Vyasadeva. Translation. O Vyasadeva, at that time, being exceedingly overpowered by feelings of happiness, every part of my body became separately enlivened. Being absorbed in an ocean of ecstasy, I could not see both myself and the Lord. Purport. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Purport. Spiritual feelings of happiness and intense ecstasies have no mundane comparison. Therefore, it is very difficult to give expression to such feelings. We can just have a glimpse of such ecstasy in the words of Sri Narad Muni. Each and every part of the body or senses has its particular function. After seeing the Lord, all the senses become fully awakened to render service unto the Lord, because in the liberated state, the senses are fully efficient in serving the Lord. As such, in that transcendental ecstasy, it so happened that the senses became separately enlivened to serve the Lord. This being so, Narad Muni lost himself in seeing both himself and the Lord simultaneously. ओम अज्ञान तिमिरंदस्य ज्ञानंजना शलाखय चक्षुरुन्मिलितं येन तस्मै श्री गुरुवे नमः श्री चैतन्य मनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूप कदामयं ददाति स्वपदांतिकं वंदेहं श्री गुरुं श्रीयुत पदकमलं श्री गुरुं वैष्णवंश श्री रूपं साग्रजातां सहगना रघुनाथान्वितां तां सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजना सहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपरा सहगना ललिता श्री विशाखान्वितांश्च हे कृष्णा करुणा सिंधु दीनबंधु जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधाकांत नमोस्तुते तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानु सुते देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिये वांछकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुव एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे Hare Krishna. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada is describing briefly about the Narad Muni's ecstasies, which he is relating to Vyasadeva. He says that all the senses are awakened and each and every one has his own function. And also that there is no mundane comparison to this feeling of ecstasy. That he said very difficult to give expression to such feelings. Now, it is so far removed from... This is a pure devotee who is saying, albeit for the benefit of all of us, of what the... that we only get a glimpse of these ecstatic feelings. But if you take a look and see why, forget ecstasy, but even in terms of just the happiness, regular happiness that we all look forward to, that is the purpose of our life. We all want happiness. It's not the purpose of our life, but it is what we all look forward to. It is usually fleeting and temporary. So one needs to reflect as to why is that so? Because if you go to see that over the last 200-400 years, you know, there has been so many massive increases in comforts. You know, there has been comforts and so many technological advancements, like there's air travel and then there's all kinds of telecommunications and, you know, mobile, laptop, conveniences which have improved our functioning. But at the same time, the level of unhappiness has increased substantially. So, one would say, well, happiness and unhappiness is a subjective feeling. How do you measure it? You can't say it just like that. That is true. But we can also observe people. We can observe and see what is their, in one's life, what is it that they do, and from that we make some judgments. Because, for instance, if people resort to destructive sources of relief in one extreme, and it is an extreme, but it is followed by hundreds of millions of people, like, for instance, drugs or alcohol, or even, what to say of that, but even if there is a compulsive viewing of TV or, movies, when I say compulsive means hours and hours every day, then clearly that's an expression of boredom at best. That you say that the person is really bored, he has nothing else to do. And at worst, it could be that the person is very distressed, very unhappy. I remember when I had done an executive education course overseas about almost 30 years ago. So that time, we never had any of these, in India also we didn't have the mobile phones. TV was the main kind of entertainment apart from movies. So one professor had mentioned at that time that in the US, an average child between the age of 4 and 16 would have seen 13,000 acts of violence. Typically American, how they calculate this, I don't know, but because they said they generally view 6 hours a day. That is the average. Now we are talking of 30 years ago, and before the advent of Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and, you know, whatever other WhatsApps and movies, on everything is on demand, it is just exponentially exploded. So it is an indication that there are problems in this world. The point is that we're talking of unhappiness because this is one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that there is a statistic that says that there are more suicides than murders in the world. People who killing others is a bad thing, and that's a huge number, but people killing themselves is even larger. There's more than 1 million people a year are killed, which comes to something like almost every 50 seconds. Now, from the time I started speaking, in the last 20 minutes, probably 60 people have committed suicide. It's one indication of how grave the situation is. Just because we don't see and we don't relate to because the world is so large. But so that is why the World Health Organization, which is nominally the kind of universal or the institute which just is supposed to be overall in charge of health, has considered this an alarming, not only it's not only a health issue, but a social, not a social health crisis only, but it's not only a mental health crisis, but also a social health crisis, because it affects families. And it affects, one such case It affects so many people around it, you know, not just the immediate family, the outer family. It really shakes one. So, clearly we can say that happy people don't commit suicide, isn't it? So that's an indication of why there is unhappiness. So it's a paradox that the comforts have been increasing and unhappiness is also increasing so much. So clearly there is something that we are missing out on. So, His Grace Chaitanya Charan Prabhu gives a very nice analogy, like to understand this a little bit more, that, you know, if you see somebody in your family who rushes out of in a frenzy, gets in a car and is going somewhere, and you have to ask that, you know, where are you going? And the person says that, I'm going to fill my petrol in the car. So, okay, then what about after that? Then I'll fill another, go to another gas station, petrol station, and fill petrol. After that, then I'll go to another petrol station. So, you think this is, it doesn't make sense. So, the point is that the car needs petrol, the car needs fuel. Without that, the car won't function. But that is what the car, that is what the vehicle, the fuel is what the car lives with, not what the car lives for. It is not the purpose of the car. The purpose of the car is different. So similarly, if we take that comparison to our lives, that there are many things that we live with, but that is different than what we live for. So for instance, our health, our wealth, our social connections, our family, etc. I mean, these are things which we live with, not what we live for. But what we live for, that knowledge is completely conspicuously absent. It's not available, not taught anywhere. That is the where the real problem is. So why is that so? Because typically, if you ask people, and even if you ask the most intelligent people, intelligent, quote-unquote, in terms of academically intelligent, maybe brilliant, who are materialistically very well situated, what is the purpose of life? A large number will say there is life has no purpose. That is the general common thinking. Now, again, this is quite absurd, because on one hand, if you take an analogy of a code, you know, like in intelligence agencies or during war times, they use codes, Morse code, or so these codes have to be uncoded, right? So if I prepare a code, right, and if I send it, the other, say a spy has sent it back to his, handler, and then it has to be uncoded. So they take a lot of painstaking efforts to decipher word by word, letter by letter first, word by word, and slowly get a, start making sense. So each word, each letter makes sense, and then slowly, so if one says that I've understood each letter and each word, but the whole message I don't understand, it doesn't make sense, right? So similarly here, we look at different things. So science has a way of explaining so many things in life. For instance, if we say electricity is gone off, we say, the power is gone off, we say electricity is gone. Or apple has fallen, and said the law of gravity is there. We can explain why the earth moves on its axis. We can explain why the snow falls, or why the ocean tides rise, right? Or why the temperatures increase. We can explain that. But if we were to say, so, and science is needed to explain and understand, to make us understand the different facets of how the universe works. So, how different aspects work. But then if one were to say, overall, we understand each part, but then we said, no, overall, it doesn't make sense. I mean, there is no purpose. So we say that each part has a purpose. Each part has a purpose, it has a reason. But then if you combine the whole picture, you don't have, it doesn't make sense. To say that, I know why the rain falls, but what is the purpose of life? There's no purpose. So that doesn't make sense, it's completely absurd. So the reason is because science studies objective reality. You know, it studies things, it studies matter. But There are two things. Matter is one thing, and what matters is another thing. So for us, what matters is most important, not only matter. So study of matter is important at a certain level, but study of what matters to us is much is a different aspect, and that's what where it is based on a different, totally different criterion. Again, he gives a very nice example of, like, if you meet if you have met someone and you go home and say that I met a very interesting person, and they say, okay, who, so tell me more. So he's saying, well, he's 5 feet 6 inches. What more? He's 70 kgs. Now, that's those parameters are there, but that is not how you describe people. You describe people about their relationships, about their nature or likes, dislikes, whatever levels you know them. You know, the physical parameters may be present, but that's not how we relate to people. Or similarly, if you are having, say, patata vada for your lunch, and if you were to ask your mother what is there for lunch, you're saying, if there is a spherical object which is 3 by 3 and so much mass and so much weight. I mean, we know it, but the thing is, food is something which we experience. So relationships is what we experience. So basically, experience is what matter. So what matters to us is not just the objective, the parameters, but what matters is how we experience internally. So that internal feeling is not taught to us in life in general. We just go instinctively. And because there is no knowledge, because there is no understanding of that anywhere in a structured way, and we just tend to go for, as Prabhupada says, increasing our animal propensities. So eating, sleeping, mating, defending, but in a more sophisticated way. I remember when I heard about, when Prabhupada's philosophy and when it was being discussed, and that was the first time I heard, probably all of us heard for the first time, this comparison that we are like animals, two-legged animals is what he said. So it was strange to hear that. And then the argument being that animals do eat, sleep, mate and defend, and human beings also do that, but in a more sophisticated way. So then it started making sense that, yes, it is true that it doesn't look like that, but if you actually sit and analyze, it is true that animals will eat whatever is there on the road. We will eat in a better way, maybe fine dining restaurants or something, takeaways, take homes, whatever, or the finest things at home. Similarly, sleeping, etc. For procreation also, maybe we will maybe having look for the most attractive partners, etc. So we feel, as human beings feel, and that is the only way, but actually all the animals do the same. So Prabhupada called it that if we don't get guidance, we'll be working only on a level of the animals. So we can conclude that looking for happiness is beyond the sphere of science. And that's where the challenge is, because we are so overawed with science, and science has contributed so much to progress of our, in many ways, the technological advancement and the comforts, conveniences that we have, that we can't see beyond that, and that we tend to look everything from the eyes of science. And science has its limitations. Science may be valuable knowledge, but it has its limitations. There are many different branches of knowledge, and science is only one aspect of it. It is just giving us the physical. It doesn't give us the much more important internal, mental, emotional understanding, and what to speak of the spiritual dimension, that is the most important thing. Let's look at it another way, that there was a survey done. They regularly do these surveys about what are the top 10 fears, what people are afraid of, and to see whether they change over time. So there are two new fears which have come in the last, say, 2 decades compared to 50 years ago in the top 10. Although most of the others are standard, basically, it is more or less the same. The two new fears are the fear of terrorism and the fear of rejection. Now, this fear of rejection is that nobody wants to be rejected. But that is such a big fear, especially in the educated class, because that it hurts the ego. And it that nobody wants to, it is very painful. Now, there is no way to measure that pain. So when we talk of quantifying, which science is good at, there is no painometer to say that this is the level of pain. Or if you have fractured your leg and you are in pain, and the doctor said, he can say that, maybe your bone is displaced or cracked or whatever, but there's no way to say how much pain there is. Same way with love. Love also, like a mother sacrifice at the time of at the time of birth, the infant will not survive. None of us will survive if our mothers have not really done what they did, especially for the first year or so. So that kind of love, nobody can measure it. So there are many aspects to that which we cannot understand, because these are only experiences internally. They are not something which is measured externally. So they are real, but they cannot be measured. So basically, we can conclude that what matters to us most is not just matter, but what is happening internally, what we experience, every aspect of our life. And that's where the issue of happiness comes. Another example is, a person who's working on the roads, toiling, say, building a construction site worker in the month of May, he'd be sweating profusely. But if you take a person who, say a software engineer sitting in an air-conditioned office, now, that's externally, that's a very comfortable feeling. But he may be sweating also because of the stress. And when he's in stress, he doesn't experience the air-conditioned comfort of the room. The last thing in his mind is, like the person who's working outside, maybe thinking, I wish I was sitting in an air-conditioned room. But the person inside, he's not considered because he's already under tremendous stress. And oftentimes we go under stress. We don't then look at the external comforts that may be around us because of the internal stress. So, this aspect of what matters internally is not discussed, not brought up, because that is the starting point of, understanding how spirituality actually has a role to play. And that's left to people's own decisions. And then whatever gives us pleasure, we do those things. Yes, there is a certain amount of pleasure allotted to it, but when we exceed that, when we are left to our own senses, then it, beyond a certain point, actually nature has allotted certain amount of pleasure, but we tend to exceed that, and then the pain starts, and then because we got used to it, and then then we get the backlash. And in any sphere, even in, say, eating, if you like some things and you eat more, you get indigestion, you fall sick. If somebody is very sexually addicted, then he will have many other diseases and problems. If somebody has is making a lot of money or very successful in what he's doing, and he goes into excess, and he gets blood pressure problems and heart problems, anxieties. So we can see that for most people, the source of happiness is often the cause of unhappiness. Because, this is graphically shown in the case of people who are addicted. That is a very clear thing, that those, someone likes, say, alcohol, then they go beyond a certain level and get so addicted to it that becomes the most important thing in their life. But then that is not, that is temporarily feeling that is giving them happiness, but eventually is giving the greatest unhappiness, or drug addiction, or any kind of physical addiction. And you extend that a little bit and you say that even the attachments that we have, they are very subtle, they may not be externally grossly compared to addictions. But there's a very thin line that if we don't even understand that attachments can lead to frustrations and pain for anything. It could be for our spouse, family, for our wealth, for our health, for our body. So many things which we get most of the time unknowingly. Slowly it just becomes it becomes a way of life and becomes just the most important aspect of our life. Then We get used to it, and then inevitably when things don't go that way, because everything is temporary, life of dualities, and when things don't go away, things turn against us, we are not prepared. And that's where the sudden frustration, anger, pain comes from that. So our scriptures say that, you know, this happiness which we're looking from sensations, from our senses, are very temporary. And that is a starting point of understanding that if we cannot just go by our own senses, that we are not meant to be like animals, to be instinctive. We have to be rational, we have to be intelligent, to use our intelligence to be able to control the mind. Then we will understand that the misery, where the sources of misery come from. But today around us, all the things that we see are generally all where the happiness is entirely coming through sensations. You know, what makes us feel good, that is, that's what we do. Even in spirituality, when we come into spiritual, or when we come into, let's say, there are, you know, we go through the various modes, and the mode of ignorance, mode of passion, mode of goodness. So there are gross levels, but even in the mode of goodness, when we now, let's say we go to the mountaintop and we say, we equate feel-good factor with spirituality. So we go to the mountaintop and say, oh, this is so spiritual. Yeah, so what we mean is that it is something much nicer, you know, the nature is so nice. But it is just because it makes us feel good. It isn't, one has to go beyond that. So this good feeling we have to recognize, because if we go only by feeling, what makes me feel good, it may be gross, it may be subtle, but that feeling good factor is today equated to happiness. And that is actually where, then it is a trap, because then we do things only where which make us feel good. And that feeling good is not always very often doesn't take us to happiness, because it will actually lead us to addiction or lead us to getting used to something. And also most important, keeping us away from the real knowledge that actually that is not what we are meant to be doing. So, and the thing, what happens today is that when we see everyone following the same pattern and seemingly derive happiness from something or the other, some success or some object, and then if we follow that and everyone is not the same and we don't get it, then the bigger problem is that we feel that something's wrong with me, because why I'm not getting the happiness, why somebody else is getting the happiness, that means I have to do something. The problem is with me, when we don't have this. So, if someone else is getting the sensation of and feeling happy, and I'm not feeling happy, then there's something wrong with me. It becomes a problem. And also, the nature of the world is that the sensations don't last long. Even if you go to a mountaintop or a beautiful resort, you go there and you feel so nice. But there are people who work there. They don't feel the same because they've got used to it. So the same person, like you go to a garden and you feel it's astonishingly beautiful. There are thousands of roses and lilies and beautifully arranged, and you are in a different world, you feel temporarily. So it's nice to go. It is not that we shouldn't go, but the understanding that that is what is, that feel-good factor is what is leading me is not correct, because the gardener who's working there, he's working for 30 years, he doesn't feel that. He feels it's a chore. He feels he has to come there and do the work. So that, there is a law of diminishing returns. In economics is taught, and also it is in reality that, you know, there is, after some time, everything that's temporary then starts getting, the sensations also diminish, vanish, and in fact it becomes the opposite sensation. You know, then you just can't stand it. For instance, if you've eaten, 3-4 gulab jambos because you're looking forward to it, and then someone comes and dumps 5 other gulab jambos, you know, you're completely stuffed. And then you can't even stand the sight of it. So, I remember one, in 1977, with my wife and, you know, just after our marriage, we had gone to the U.S. First time we visited then, we went straight to a hotel, and we were looking forward to pizzas, because we heard so much about it. And then we didn't understand that in the U.S. they have these massive size pizzas, you know, they ask, grandfather size, father size, or normal size. So we ordered grandfather size. And it was so much that after that, we couldn't even stand the sight of it. We had to keep it outside. So my cousin, we kept it outside his room, and he would keep it outside. We didn't even want the smell of it. So it becomes, completely antagonistic to what we were initially feeling. So now the most important understanding is what our scriptures tell us is that why this is happening is because happiness is the best experience as a byproduct. Happiness is not as a product. If you pursue happiness, sooner or later you will be having difficulties. But if you are doing something meaningful, and if you have got a purpose in life, and if you are fulfilling that purpose, and the byproduct, if you are doing it sincerely, and that the byproduct, when happiness, with that which comes along with it, the happiness of serving, the happiness of overcoming challenges, happiness of facing difficulties, happiness of pleasing others, that happiness is really the lasting happiness. And that is what our scriptures tell us, where spirituality dimension is important, where it brings in the understanding that we are spiritual beings and then we need to evolve. So understanding that we're not this body is the starting point, but from that it goes into a level of that how do we increase our capacity to understand, our knowledge base increases, the real knowledge of what this who Krishna is, who what is our position, what is the position of all other living beings, how we are tiny, infinitesimal, etc. And then from that, the capacity to, the knowledge increases and we get wisdom to understand how to behave in certain ways. And along with it, our capacity to love, our compassion, our desire to help others would also increase. So then with the wisdom, with the knowledge, then the love is directed to the right channels. So, and then ultimately, you know, there's a hierarchy of important things in our life. There are so many things that we want to do and we are pursuing. So without knowledge, we will pursue what we want. We'll do this, we'll do that, we'll do this, do that. This gives me happiness, that gives me happiness. We just, and then that way we're lurching from one to the other, up and down. It's like we've been tossed around in waves. But when this wisdom comes and it gives us, channels our thinking into, our understanding into what real love is, and we attempt to substitute our hierarchy, then at the top of the hierarchy, usually the top is always what is most important. So if for a sports lover, if cricket is the most important, he's frustrated because his team loses, or eventually how long does the, you know, you can't go whole life just looking for that. Or an alcoholic, he thinks alcohol is most important. But eventually if we take Krishna as the topmost on the hierarchy, that's our goal. Because then he's the lasting friend. Everybody wants a lasting relationship. And nothing which is something which is eternal. You know, if you see, it's interesting to know that we in why movies, you know, generally they have this romance, and then eventually they always have happily ever after themes. Even for children, storybooks, etc., there's happily ever after, the king and the queen and the prince and the princess, whatever, everything is fine and settled. So that means they're talking of eternally. But actually around us, nothing is lasting forever. Nothing. Not only us, but even if you take mountains, dynasties, kingdoms, everything is temporary. So where is this desire for lasting longing come from? This is interesting to understand where it is coming from, because we have never experienced anything. So that is because we have a spark of spirit. Our spirit, the soul which is within, is eternal and is looking for that eternal connection. And because it is not getting that, therefore it is lurching here and there. So if once we attempt to, and that is where say Krishna consciousness or spiritual evolution really is driving for, and gradually putting us into a level of understanding that what is Krishna's role is everywhere. He's a friend for us. He's eternal. He's the cause of all causes, but he's also our closest friend, who will always be a friend even if we reject him. Even if we do wrong things, even if we do bad things, he's always waiting for us. He's waiting. He doesn't judge us. He's willing. He's hoping that we don't we get out of this karmic reactions, come to him. So that kind of friend, that's where this knowledge chasm is there. So if we somehow are able to bring our knowledge to understand and put Krishna slowly, slowly up on the, in the, and it is, those who are able to put Krishna as the highest center. Let's take Prabhupada's example. Prabhupada, of course, was a pure devotee from birth. But because Krishna was at the highest hierarchy, at top of his hierarchy, everything that he did, you know, at any point of his life, was always to see how he could serve. Because his Guru Maharaj also had that, so he wanted to please his Guru Maharaj to reach Krishna. Now, it explains everything. We don't need to go into details because we know, but you know, why he took this 70 years old, at 70 he took this voyage, etc. All the austerity he went through. But the important point is, now look at his disciples. His disciples started out with, they are typically the ones who were, let's say, almost all of them were in that level of sensation seekers. They went in, many of them went into drugs or alcohol, or they were dissatisfied with so many things in their life and they were experimenting with various things. So it was a classic case of that, you know, those, and Prabhupada went to them and look at the evolution that has happened. Their capacity to understand, their knowledge, just because they sincerely followed their guru, without even knowing who a guru is, but just sincerely, faithfully following the regulative principles, trying to please him, gradually their knowledge base increased, their wisdom increased, and we are talking of 55 years ago, 56 years ago, so many of them are there today. And then gradually, because their wisdom increased and then their compassion increased, their desire to please Prabhupada increased, only that completely transformed everything. And so we don't have to see anywhere beyond that. We can, you know, anybody objectively analyzing the ISKCON movement or any other genuine spiritual movement can see transformation and exactly living scriptures. How a scripture actually takes, how happiness can come. And this happiness, mind you, it has come, if you go to see the austerities that they have gone through, you know, we have heard about it, but actually we cannot understand the kind of difficulties unless we delve deep into it, the challenges that went through it. Prabhupada's challenges are well documented, but at least for one, let's say when we read Giriraj Maharaj's book, I'll Build You a Temple, about the whole Juhu's chapter, or if you take Mukund Maharaj's, you know, book, Miracle on Second Avenue, about the initial days in New York, San Francisco, or Ranchot Prime Prabhu's book on London, you know, When the Sun Shines. They're classics, actually. What was really mind-boggling, I mean, amazing, that first of all, it involved hundreds of devotees, but the poverty they went through, the austerity they went through for years and years. Like those who came to India, most of them are Westerners, they have never lived here, and in 50 years ago, you know, if they didn't get, most of them fell in with a fever, malaria, they recovered, then they get jaundice, you know, they were just, and then you know, rats and the filth, I mean, and then the cheating, everybody would cheat them. Prabhupada knew that. So, this was the kind of difficulty, and still they were blissful. Still they were blissful. How Prabhupada beautifully brought them. He started the movement by sitting, if you take if you take symbolically, I mean, he was sitting under Tompkins Square Park, and that is the, you can see the iconic, you know, picture. That though it was 26 Second Avenue, but you know, Tompkins Square Park was when he took it public. He sat under the tree, started chanting, and then the fight ended. This initial devotees were with him, then the crowd started coming, and then he started doing it. So, in spite of all these challenges of the devotees, they went into Harinam. They went into, you know, and it was not forced. You could see they're so happy. I mean, the chanting and the dancing was so happy, whether in the temple, outside. So the difficulties, the challenges were there. But how is it that they were happy? So this is in complete contrast to those who may be externally having all the trappings of happiness, but internally they're completely devoid, you know, and they're so miserable. So there is a complete opposite. So, anybody who is really seeking happiness and also has a little objectivity cannot but come to the conclusion that really, just because I have a difficulty in following the process is another thing. If there are challenges, there's another thing. But if I want happiness, you cannot dispute this, and it's an open and shut case. It's a no-brainer in one way. But the difficulty is only because we are so used to our lifestyle and you know, our being away. But initially, as we've all seen also, that whatever, you know, we have got a taste, otherwise we would not be here. And that taste is real. You know, the taste of enjoying serving others, or, you know, trying to please our guru, pleasing the other Vaishnavas, and following the orders of the spiritual guru, you know, whether it is in the, whatever various services, there are hundreds and hundreds of services. So even those devotees who are opening new temples and failed, 108 temples opened during Prabhupada's time, but there were hundreds of others which did not succeed. There it was no matter, external success was not at all a criterion. You know, the happiness was still there. And in Krishna's eyes it was still, is the same. So this kind of knowledge, this kind of evolution is really what actually stands us for the rest of our lives. And somehow to cling to that, we need that association. And that association is meant to observe. We see, we just discussed about Prabhupada. No, we read about Prabhupada, we hear about him, we talk about his disciples. But when we observe them and go into that, you know, His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj's Journey Home book is a classic example of that. So when we see that how others have transcended pain or problems or challenges which are far worse than what we would have experienced, and they have found happiness, lasting happiness, and they are continuing stable in a very stable condition continuously, then we realize that at least we know where we need to go. When we talk of life has no purpose, life has a purpose, and life has a process, and there's an approach also. That is already clear. Now is the next step is that how do we go ahead and follow that? And that's where association comes. Genuine association means not only the we get association through the books, through the other devotees, through darshan, through if we are sincere and we are seeking the right thing with the right motive, then that process slowly pushes us on into that. It can be slow, it can be fast, but it depends upon our sincerity and our steadfastness. So, keeping Krishna in the top of the hierarchy of important things is, so everyone is important things. So everyone in that sense is seeking a God. Whether he believes in God or not, he or she, but they are seeking something. What we call God is something most important. Now if God happens to be Krishna, is Krishna, and for us it becomes Krishna, then everything falls into place. But if God happens to be cricket or happens to be something, you know, and if that's the only thing, then we are bound to be miserable. And today, people going by sensations, what happens is that the sensation is so important, feeling good factor. That's why we go headlong into processes which are diverting us. For instance, the entertainment. Now, a society values what it values most. A society values what it's put its worth, maximum value for, the money value also. So if you see entertainment, sports stars, celebrities, all over the world, I mean, they're mind-boggling. People earn $100 million a year. There was some years ago, the heavyweight championship boxing, and it was, you know, there was a lot of marketing done. The winner, it's a 45-minute, 3 minutes, 15 rounds, 45 minutes boxing, the winner got $100 million. You know, obviously people hear and see that, then that becomes a goal that I could do it also. I mean, you feel internally. Or we read about somebody on the, in the business world, someone making money, or someone looking good, someone. So everything then that becomes a distraction, and then that is something now, immediate, and something which I feel I can forget the future. So that becomes a very destructive thing for us. So the spiritual, because we are spirit soul and we have this spark, and then if we somehow connect it to the eternal, then this desire for eternal lasting peace that we all the themes talk of ever after is possible, because then that transcends our immediate problems and challenges, and also it fits in exactly into what the scriptures tell us, that this body is only one, this life is only one, we have got this body. But there are many lives, and you know, eternally we can have a lasting relationship. So, ultimately bhakti, the bhakti movement is not about rejecting things. You know, when we talk of fear or rejection, bhakti is really about reconnecting. And that's we see in Prabhupada's life as a classic history, that he reconnected everyone to the source of happiness. That was his whole purpose of life. If we were to define what his life was, we can say that his whole life was to how he could reconnect. Rather than reject, he was actually reconnecting everyone and anyone, anywhere in the world, without any discrimination. He didn't even meet those people. He went to places where, when he went first to Butler, Pennsylvania, there was only one Indian there. That was Mr. Agarwal, Sally Agarwal's husband. And they'd never seen anyone. So the Agarwals also were so embarrassed and nervous that they put him in a yoga, YMCA rather. So, and Prabhupada took everything, so from there, he was completely on a different level. So he didn't, you know, his happiness was based only on seeing wherever anyone had any problems in life, how I could bring them and connect them to the eternal soul. So basically, if we can adopt this and try to make a positive difference in the lives of others, in some way, it can be in our own family to start with. First of all, in our life, everything starts with us. So can we make a positive difference in our life? That we slowly, if our anger gets down, if our negative emotions are down, if our anarthas start going down, that's progress. And that comes through this. So we have enough telltale signs to tell us that we are on the right path. When we move into that, then we have a desire to help others. Then we will be seeing that how I can help my family who are around us in any small way. Just because then we are not concerned with people seeing us or not seeing us. It's just that we want to do it. And then it transcends into our community, other devotees. And then the association helps us to see how others are coping with it. This is the beauty of association also. When we meet devotees, when we exchange understanding, and most of the time we are always not aware of the other people's challenges. And when we become aware of those challenges, we feel that we didn't even, if I had known those, then compared to that, my challenges are very minuscule. So that also helps us to not only face the problem, but overcome. So that's where the help is there. It's like the example that His Holiness Radharani Maharaj gives in the book and about the redwood trees, you know, those 5,000-year trees in California, that the roots are not very deep, but they spread very, very wide. And then they intertwine and then they help each other. So that help is really where, that's the way devotees are. That, we may be various, we may not be in the same city, or we may not be in the same country also. But if the relationships are there and we know, then we are there for each other to help. And that becomes a meaningful goal, and then that takes us to a lasting happiness. See, life is going to hurt us in many ways. And there's going to be challenges are there. This is the Dukhale Mashashvatam is for real. You know, that is, it is to give us a gentle nudge, you can say, that look, all the time, that, you know, we are, look, this is not your, don't settle down here forever. It is a temporary, transient moment. You have to go, your final destination is elsewhere. So we take advantage of that and we look at it that way, cope with it the way we can, but move on and try to see and take a relationship to Krishna. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, if you become conscious of me, you will overcome all obstacles by my grace. He guarantees that. So that's the last final proof that we need. There's nothing more that we need than when Krishna himself says very clearly, distinctly that if you become conscious of me and if you, then you'll overcome all obstacles by my grace. That means Krishna's grace is always there. So we will stop here. Is there any question? Yeah, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu, for so many examples and so many points that you made. One thing I would like to sincerely ask you, that sometimes in this digital age, it becomes easy, you know, you are mentioning about the redwood trees, the devotees connecting. So sometimes it becomes easier to connect and help and receive help from devotees who are far away. But this is my personal observation, that I can help devotees who stay in another city. And I can receive help from devotees who stay in another city. But sometimes it becomes extremely challenging to connect to somebody who's sitting next to you. So there's so much connectivity digitally that I think it is robbing us of a chance of connecting locally. So I just thought I should, you know, hear from you that how do we sincerely overcome this? We want to help, we want to connect, but it seems it's more easier, the whole facility is to connect to people who are staying long distance rather than to connect to somebody who's next to you. So can you please help?
Yeah. So again, whatever we take, when we take others' help, as I said before, the digital age also, when we take others' help, if we are grateful for the help and if we see it in the light, that we don't... So same way here in the digital age, all the tools that we have, if we get enamored by it, and if that... Because that is ultimately very impersonal also. So if we are aware of the dangers that it is...
are going to, the personal association is going to reduce, and then we take the help when we need it, but not get overcome. So yes, it's a real danger. So we have to be constantly aware, and we can always rationalize and we can get carried away to such an extent. Like even say Facebook or things, or there's always an innocent reason. Okay, we're making friends and so on, but that I can preach to that. It may be, but then we have to be fully aware of the dangers. So ultimately it depends on our sincerity. If we are sincere, then we are willing to hear from others and hear the danger. Because these are told by at different levels. We constantly hear the potential dangers of social media or the digital age. Dangers in the sense that of ourselves. You know, it may, by itself, it has nothing wrong with it. You know, the Prabhupada's example of the microphone is how we use it. Or the knife in the surgeon's hand. So it's a great tool, and we are seeing all the leaders of ISKCON also use it. But then they have a use of it, and they see that it is only a tool, but not beyond that. But if we get enamored, you know, if we are completely, and then we spend much more time, and if we are, more important, if we start, if we're not even aware that we are actually neglecting our foremost duty, is that to help those devotees whom we can personally counsel, talk to them, just help them, sit with them. That is a thing which is always there, and that is what has really brought us to this level, for all of us. Somebody or the other did that. So that, without neglecting that, if we are able to take the help and improve our productivity to help others and to keep in touch, then it's great. Then we can have a win-win situation. So it has its advantages, but it has to be seen, you know, at a distance and in a controlled way. That's very critical. So at all times, I think, I would say, you know, temples or any institutions, projects, at least within the ISKCON world, they should be periodically, brought to the notice that, okay, hey, don't get carried away. There is a limit. And then what are the telltale signs? One which you clearly said that we are, we will be conversing and talking to others, which is fine. But our various services are there, and are the services being hindered in any way? That needs to be, there has to be a check all the time. Yeah, so the last question. Thank you.
Thank you, Nandadulal Prabhu and Krishnachandra Prabhu. It was a nice question answer. But I was just thinking that is this because, you know, we have also ourselves become so impersonal. Now, for example, I'm just giving analogy of how things were like 25 years back, where we had a television set in the living room, and you know all the family members would congregate and just watch one or two programs, right? But today, the television set has essentially moved to everybody's bedroom, right? So everybody has their own bedroom; they watch their own program. So this is just one analogy, but the connection between the people have essentially become so impersonal today that it is easier for us to connect with somebody in an impersonal way rather than on a personal way. Like as Nandadulal Prabhu was saying, somebody is sitting right next to you. You're not empathizing with what he's going through. But then, you know, somebody in some other city whom you, you know, just know on Facebook or somebody, you can help that person. So, a question that was actually asked to me for which I didn't have an answer, that ISKCON is going on with so many different projects, and you know, particularly the TOVP, such a large amount of money that is being invested over there. Of course, everything is being done for the future. But then the last 18 months to 2 years, people have been going through so much of challenges. Devotees have been suffering because they have been losing their jobs. And what is ISKCON doing for them? So the question that, you know, people want to know is how is ISKCON as a society, other than feeding, you know, just prasadam, how are you connecting with the people who are actually in financial difficulty? So again, you know, the thought that came to my mind is, you know, the necessity for us to run an institution is always there. So, you know, running a temple, you know, and doing all whatever is necessary. So there is a certain amount of financial resources that have to be connected for that. So then the challenge is what is left out, you know, in order to actually help devotees in distress. So the feeling amongst the people is that ISKCON as an institution is really not doing adequately to take care of people's emotional, you know, and their, you know, mental health during this times of crisis. So what should, what is your, you know, take on that?
Well, see, ISKCON, there are some projects which are global. Like, for instance, the TOBP mentioned it's a Mayapur-based project, but it's a global project. So ISKCON works at various levels. So there is this is the probably the biggest combined project for ISKCON, and it has far-reaching, you know, over the next several hundred years because it's scripturally mentioned. So that's on a different level. As far as the help you talked of, yes, it is necessary. And I wouldn't say it's not happening, but it may not be because ISKCON is by nature very decentralized. As you know, that it is, you know, 800 centers, restaurants, whatever, everything is very decentralized, and then they have a link with the temple president or GBC, there's a hierarchy. So it's quite, I'm sure, in fact, that many places, they must be having local initiatives of a big nature, but then that's not known elsewhere. So the best is that, you know, wherever we have our reach, if we are in one community or if we are in one city with three, four communities or three, four temples, then whatever our influence is, whatever we can do, and Chowpatty has done that. And I'm sure others must have done, at least those who have the means. But, you know, we don't have track of that, and also they don't, I mean, it's just, so it's decentralized. It's not like a corporate, you know, central with everyone then has a standard way of doing it. Each one is doing it on and on. I have no doubts that many centers must have done it, because that's the nature of devotees. Whatever within their means. If there are small temples, there may be small things, you know, in Bangladesh there may be limitations, for instance. You know, or in Pakistan, for instance, you know, we have devotees there, you know, whatever the limitations they may be doing. But in terms of large temples, they are doing it in their own way. So whether it's food distribution, but mental, emotional, that has taken probably even bigger knock. It's easier to settle the financial, the physical needs. Like even the government is giving free rations. But mental and emotional is very difficult to assess, and what to speak of the impact, you know, on the family and others. And but I'm happy to know that, you know, to have at least we have some examples, and I know that there is a major initiatives that are taken to see and to locate when this happens, and then immediately try and help wherever possible. So yes, it's an urgent need, but I think we have to do it in our own areas. Wherever we have our limited sphere of influence, within that we should do what we can. I think that's a reflection of whatever we have been taught, because by definition, spiritual progress means that or spiritual evolution means that if we put Krishna in the hierarchy, we means we put Krishna's all living beings as more important than us. At least that's our understanding, and therefore we should do anything for others. So starting with our own community would become most important, and then even beyond that. So I think in the last 10, 20 years, that way, at least in India, which we have knowledge of, there's a lot that is being done. So we stop here then. So Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram.